mortals who did not. This was a feeling that could sustain him, that could fill him up. Being a novelist, he decided, would make people like him. Well, said his mother, then you should be a novelist. Okay, he said, bleary and half awake, still not quite comprehending how deeply strange this was, his mother fully dressed, carrying a suitcase, coming in here at dawn asking about his plans, his future plans, when she had never once asked about this before. But Samuel accepted it and went along with it, like how one accepts the premise of a strange dream whose strangeness only clarifies after it's over.
You write your books, she said. I'll read them.
Okay. He wanted to show his mother the castle of no return. He'd show her his drawing of the white horse. He'd show her that thing about the bottomless pit.
I want to tell you something, she said.
And she was oddly formal about this, as if she'd privately practiced it many times.
I'm going away for a while, and I want you to be good while I'm gone.
Where are you going?
I have to find someone, she said. Someone I knew a long time ago.
A friend?
I suppose, she said.
She put a cold palm on his cheek.
But you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to be so scared anymore. That's what I wanted to tell you. Don't be scared. Can you do that for me?
Is your friend missing?
Not really. We've just been apart for a long time.
Why?
Sometimes, she said,
and she paused, and she looked away from him, and her face crumpled.
Mom, he said. Sometimes you take a wrong turn, she said. Sometimes you get lost.
Samuel started to cry. He did not know why he was crying. He tried to stop it. She gathered him in her arms and said,
"You're so sensitive."
And rocked him, and he pressed into her soft skin until his whimpering ceased and he wiped his nose.
Why do you have to go now? Samuel said.
It's just time, honey.
But why?
I don't know how to explain it, she said.
She stared at the ceiling with this hopeless look on her face, then seemed to gather herself.
Have I ever told you about the ghost that looks like a rock? She said.
No.
My father told me about it. He said you could find it on beaches sometimes back home. It looks like a normal rock, like a little stone covered with green fuzz.
How can you tell it's a ghost?
You can't, unless you take it out to sea.
If anyone takes it onto the ocean, it'll get heavier the farther you travel from shore, and if you're really far, the ghost will get so heavy it'll sink your ship. They called it a drowning stone.
Why would it do that?
I don't know. Maybe it's angry. Maybe something bad happened to it. The point is, it gets too big for you to carry anymore. And the longer you try to carry it, the bigger and heavier it gets. Sometimes it can get inside you and it gets bigger and bigger until it's too much. You can't fight it anymore. You just sink.
She stood up. Do you understand?
I think so, he said, nodding.
You will, she said. I know you will. Just remember what I told you.
Don't be scared anymore.
That's right.
She leaned over and kissed him on the forehead, held him close to her, and seemed to breathe him in.
Now go back to sleep, she said. It'll all be okay. Just remember, don't be scared.
He heard her footsteps disappear down the hall. Heard her wrestling with the suitcase down the stairs. He heard the car start, the garage door open and close. He heard her drive away. And Samuel tried to obey his mother. He tried to fall back asleep and not feel scared. But this unbearable panic rose up in him, and so he got out of bed and ran to his parents' room and found his father still sleeping, curled with his back to the room.
"Dad," Samuel said, shaking him. "Wake up."
Henry squinted at his son.
"What do you want?"
he said in a sleepy whisper.
"What time is it?"
"Mom's gone," Samuel said. Henry lifted a heavy head.
"Huh?"
"Mom's gone." His father looked at the empty side of the bed.
"Where'd she go?"
"I don't know. She drove away."
"She drove?"
Samuel nodded.
Okay, Henry said, and he rubbed his eyes. Go downstairs. I'll be there in a minute.
She's gone, Samuel said.
I got it. Please go downstairs.
And Samuel waited in the kitchen for his father until he heard a crash from his parents' bedroom. He ran upstairs and opened the door and saw his father standing straight and rigid with the reddest face Samuel had ever seen. Faye's closet door was open, some of her clothes strewn on the floor. But it wasn't the clothes Samuel would remember best, nor the crash, nor the broken pieces of a small vase that had been hurled at the wall, apparently with great force. What he would remember clearly, even decades later, was that color on his father's face. A deep crimson, and not just in the cheeks, but all over, neck and forehead and down into his chest. A dangerous-looking color.
She's gone, he said, and her stuff, it's all gone. Where did all her stuff go?
I saw her leaving with a suitcase, Samuel said.
Go to school, his father said, not looking at him.
But
don't argue,
but
just go!
Samuel didn't know what it meant, that his mother was gone. Gone where? Gone how far? When would she come back? During the journey to school, Samuel felt himself far away from his surroundings, like he was looking at the world through binoculars turned backwards, standing at the bus stop, getting on the bus, sitting and looking out the window, and not really hearing any of the kids around him, focusing on a water spot on the window glass, the passing landscape beyond all blurry and whizzing indistinctly by. Samuel felt a gathering sense of dread, and narrowing his attention to something very small, like a water spot, seemed to keep the dread, for the moment, at bay. He just needed to get to school. He just needed to talk to Bishop, to tell Bishop what had happened. Bishop, he had decided, would keep him afloat. Bishop would know what to do. Only Bishop wasn't at school. Not at his locker. Not at his desk. Gone. Bishop was gone. That word again. What did it mean, to be gone? Everyone was disappearing. Samuel sat in his chair examining the wood of his desk and didn't even notice when Miss Bowles called his name. Then again, then a third time, didn't even notice the class nervously laughing at him, nor Miss Bowles walking up the row toward him, did not even notice when she stood directly above him, waiting while the class chittered behind her. It wasn't until she touched him, physically contacted his shoulder with her hand, that he flinched and broke away from what had become a really absorbing exercise in tracing wood grain with his eyes. And he wasn't even mortified when Miss Bowles said, "Good of you to come back to us," in her mocking way to the class's laughter. He didn't even feel embarrassed. It was as if misery overwhelmed everything else. All his normal worries were buried. Gone. Example, at recess, he left. He simply marched away. He walked toward the most distant swing set and then walked on. He just didn't stop. It had never occurred to him before that he could not stop. Everyone stopped. But in the face of his mother's goneness, all the world's normal rules fell away. If she could leave, why couldn't he? So he did. He walked away and was surprised how easy it was. He walked along the sidewalk, didn't even attempt to run or hide. He walked in plain view and nobody stopped him. Nobody said a word. He floated away. It was a whole new reality. Maybe, he thought, his mother also found it this easy. To go. What kept people where they were in their normal orbits? Nothing, he realized for the first time. There was nothing to stop anyone from, on any given day, vanishing. He kept going. For hours he kept going, staring down at the sidewalk, thinking, step on a crack, break your mother's back, repeating this until he finally reached the copper front gates of Venetian Village, then slipping between the bars and not even looking at the security window, just walking right on through, and if the guard saw him, he didn't say anything, and Samuel briefly wondered if, in the middle of everything, he hadn't in fact turned invisible, such was the oddness of this total lack of reaction from the world, his breaking all the rules and the world completely not noticing. And he was thinking about this and walking via Veneto's smooth asphalt and cresting the neighborhood's gentle hill when he looked down at the street's terminating cul-de-sac and saw, in front of Bishop's house, two police cars. Samuel stopped walking. His immediate fear was that the police were looking for him, and in some way this was a relief and a comfort, because it meant that his disappearance mattered. He played the scene out in his head. The phone call from the school to his father frantic with worry, calling the police, who would ask where Samuel might go, and his father telling them, Bishop's house! Because his father knew about Bishop, had dropped him off here, and would remember this because he was a good and caring father who would not one day just leave. Samuel felt devastated by this. What had he done to his father? The agony he must have caused. His father waiting at home alone now, both his wife and son disappearing on the same day. And Samuel walked toward Bishop's house, walked with haste. He would turn himself in, be driven home, be reunited with his father, who must have been sick with worry by now. It was, he knew, the right thing to do. And he got as far as the headmaster's house before noticing something that stopped him again. Around the small post that once contained the block of poisoned salt was a line of thin, bright yellow ribbon. It was wrapped around four small stakes in the ground, making a square containing the empty post. The ribbon had words on it, and even though it had been twisted and so some of the words were upside down and backward, the message was easy to comprehend. Police line do not cross. Samuel glanced at the headmaster's hot tub and saw more of the ribbon there, too, surrounding the entire pool and deck area. And the scene in his head changed. The police were looking for him, but not because he ditched school. So he ran. Into the forest, down to the stream, splashed along its banks and breathed in the damp, leafy rot and ran in the wet sand, water bubbling up and squishing out of the ground wherever his shoes landed. The sun was blocked by the trees above him, the woods taking on that misty, bluish color of midday shade. And he saw Bishop exactly where he expected him to be, in the large oak tree by the pond, up on the sturdy first branch, hiding, mostly obscured except for his feet, which Samuel saw only because he was looking for them. Bishop climbed down out of the tree, landing on the ground with a flutter of the surrounding leaves just as Samuel arrived. "Hey, Bish," he said. "Hey." They eyed each other a moment, not knowing what to say. "Shouldn't you be in school?" Bishop said.
"I left."
Bishop nodded. "I just came from your house," Samuel said. "The police were there."
"I know."
"What do they want?"
"No idea."
"Is it about the headmaster?"
"Maybe."
"The hot tub?"
"Could be."
"What's going to happen to us?" Bishop smiled.
"So many questions," he said. "Let's swim."
He yanked off his shoes without untying them, pulled off his tube socks, and threw them inside out on the ground. His belt buckle jingled as he undid it, then he pulled off his jeans and shirt and jumped toward the water, trying as best he could to avoid sharp rocks and twigs, all flailing skinny legs and arms and underpants, which were gray-green camouflage briefs about two sizes too big. When he made it to the pond, he jumped off a tree stump and cannonballed in, broke the surface with a loud whoop. Then came back and said,
"Let's go, soldier!"
Samuel followed him, but carefully, untying his shoes and putting them where they wouldn't get wet. Pulling off his socks and stuffing them inside the shoes, taking off and folding his jeans and shirt and placing them gently on top of the shoes. He was deliberate about this. He always was. When he reached the pond, he didn't jump in, but rather waded, wincing as the cold grasped first his ankles, then knees, then waist. Then the water reached his underwear and the chill spread.
"It's easier if you jump in all at once," Bishop said.
"I know," Samuel said, "but I can't." When finally the water reached his neck and the pain subsided, Bishop said,
"Good, okay, here's the scenario."
And he outlined the premise of the game they were to play. The year would be 1836. The place would be the Mexican borderlands. The epoch was the Texas Revolution. They were to be scouts in Davy Crockett's army, spying on the enemy caught behind Mexican lines. They had important information concerning the size of Santa Anna's army, and now they needed to get it back to Crockett. The fate of the Alamo hung in the balance.
"But enemies are everywhere," Bishop said, "and rations are low."
His knowledge of American wars was thorough, impressive, and frightening. When he played war, he played it immersively. How many times had they killed each other around this pond? Hundreds of deaths, thousands of bullets, bullets sprayed along with the white spittle ejected from their mouths as they made the bullet sounds, the machine guns, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. ducking behind trees yelling, "I got you!" The pond had become sacred to them, the grounds hallowed, the water holy. They felt a kind of formality here, like the feeling one has entering a cemetery, this being the site of their own many imaginary deaths.
"Someone's coming," Bishop said, pointing. "Mexican troops. If they catch us, they will torture us for information."
"But we won't tell," Samuel said.
"No, we won't."
"Because of our training."
"That's right."
Bishop had always insisted that members of the U.S. military underwent advanced and mysterious training that allowed them to resist, among other things, pain, fear, booby traps, and drowning. Samuel had wondered how anyone could be trained not to drown. Bishop said it was classified.
"Hide," Bishop said.
Then he dropped below the water. Samuel looked upstream to where he'd been pointing but saw nothing. He tried to imagine enemy troops advancing on their position, tried to call up the usual fear he felt during these games, tried to see the bad guys, which up until now was always very easy. To see them, the bad guys, whatever bad guys they were fighting that day, Soviet spies, the Viet Cong, the Redcoats, stormtroopers, all they'd have to do was say it aloud and they were there, before them. Their imaginations melted into the real world. This was usually so simple that Samuel had never thought about it before, not until this moment when it stopped working. He saw nothing, felt nothing. Bishop popped out of the water to find Samuel staring at the trees.
"Hello, soldier," he said. "We're gonna get caught?"
"It's not working," Samuel said.
"What's not working?"
"My brain."
"What's wrong?"
Bishop said. His mind felt overwhelmed. All he could see was his mother. Her absence. She was like a fog that obscured everything. He was not even able to pretend.
"My mom is gone," he said. And even as he said it, he felt the crying come. The familiar throat constriction, the way his chin tightened and balled up like a rotten apple. Sometimes he hated himself so much.
"What do you mean, gone?" Bishop said.
"I don't know."
"She left?"
Samuel nodded.
"Is she coming back?"
He shrugged. He didn't want to talk. Another word would make the crying start.
"So there's a chance she won't come back?"
Bishop said. Samuel nodded again.
"You know what?" he said. "You're lucky. Seriously, I wish my parents would leave. You might not understand it now, but your mother's done you a favor."
Samuel looked at him helplessly.
"How?"
His throat felt like a hose with a knot in it.
"Because you get to be a man now," Bishop said. "You're free."
Samuel did not respond, just hung his head. Below him he dug his bare feet into and out of the mud. This seemed to help.
"You don't need your parents," Bishop said. "You may not realize it now, but you don't need anybody. This is an opportunity. This is your chance to become a different person, a new and better person."
Samuel found a small, smooth stone on the bottom of the pond. He picked it up with his toes, then let it go.
"It's like you're going through training," Bishop said. "Difficult training that will eventually make you stronger."
"I'm not a soldier," Samuel said. "This isn't a game."
"Sure it is," Bishop said. "Everything is a game, and you have to decide whether you're going to win or lose."
"This is stupid." Samuel made his way out of the pond, back to the tree where he'd organized his clothes. He sat down in the dirt and brought his knees up to his chest and wrapped his arms around his legs and rocked slowly back and forth. At some point the crying had started. His nose was now running, his face squished, his lungs spasming. Bishop followed him out.
"Right now I'd say you're losing."
"Shut up.
You have a losing quality about you at this moment."
Bishop stood above him closely, his dripping underpants sagging ridiculously between his legs. He tugged them up.
"You know what you need to do?" Bishop said. "You need to replace her."
"That's impossible."
"Not with another mother. With another woman."
"Whatever."
"You need to find a woman."
"For what?"
"For what?"
Bishop laughed.
"A woman to, you know, to take advantage of, to take liberties with."
"I don't want that."
"There are plenty who will let you."
"That won't help."
"Sure it will."
He took a step closer, leaned down and touched Samuel's cheek with the palm of his hand. It was cold and damp, but also tender, soft.
You've never been with a girl, right?
Samuel looked up at him, still hugging his own legs. He was beginning to shiver.
Have you?
He said. Bishop laughed again. I've done all sorts of things.
Like what?
Bishop stood silent a moment, then withdrew his hand. He walked over to the tree and leaned against it, pulling up his soggy underpants.
There are lots of girls at school. You should ask one out.
That's not going to help.
There's got to be someone, right? Who are you in love with?
Nobody.
That's not true. Tell me there's somebody. I already know who it is.
You do not.
I do, too. You might as well say it.
Bishop took a few steps towards Samuel and put his hands on his hips, one leg out, a pose that was conqueror triumphant.
It's Bethany, isn't it? He said. You're in love with my sister.
No, I'm not, Samuel said. But he knew as he said it that it wasn't convincing. He said it with too much urgency, too loudly, too much protest. He was not a good liar.
You're in love with her, Bishop said. You want to fuck her, I can tell these things.
You're wrong.
It's okay, listen, you have my permission.
Samuel stood up. I should go home, he said.
Seriously, ask her out.
My dad is probably wondering where I am.
Don't go,
Bishop said. He clutched Samuel's shoulders to stop him.
Please stay.
Why?
There's something you need to see.
I should go.
It'll only take a second.
What is it?
Close your eyes.
How can you show me something if I'm closing my eyes?
Trust me.
Samuel blew a long, loud breath meant to convey his impatience in all this. He closed his eyes. He felt Bishop let go of his shoulders. He heard the sound of Bishop moving in front of him, a footfall, then another, something wet splatting on the ground.
When you open your eyes, Bishop said, only open them a tiny bit, like a squint.
Fine.
No more than a squint, okay? Do it.
He opened his eyes, only a fraction. At first there was nothing but indistinct smudges of light, the abstract brightness of the day, a blur of Bishop before him, a round pink blob. Samuel opened his eyes a little wider. Bishop stood there, a few feet away. He was, Samuel could now tell, naked. His underwear lay wetly at his feet, and Samuel's gaze drifted to his crotch. This was involuntary. It happened all the time, in locker rooms, at urinals, any opportunity to compare his own body with the bodies of other boys. Who was bigger, who was smaller? These questions seemed enormously important, so he looked. But where Bishop's prick should have been, Samuel saw nothing. Bishop was leaning forward, canted at the waist. His legs were slightly bent at the knees in a sort of half-bow or curtsy. He had hidden his prick, Samuel could now see. He tucked it between his legs so that all Samuel saw was a smooth, soft nothingness.
"This is what she looks like," Bishop said. "My sister."
"What are you doing?"
"We're twins. This is what she looks like."
Samuel stared at Bishop's body, his skinny torso, ribs showing through the skin, but rigid also, tense and solid. He stared at that triangle of skin between his legs.
"You can pretend I'm her," Bishop said.
He stepped toward Samuel and pressed his cheek to Samuel's and whispered into his ear,
"Just pretend."
Samuel felt Bishop's hands on his waist, then felt them gently pulling down his underwear, felt the wet fabric plop against his feet, felt the tiny wobble of his own prick, withered by the cold.
"Pretend I'm Bethany."
Then Bishop turned around and all Samuel could see was the small pale sweep of his shoulders and back. Bishop took both Samuel's hands and guided them to his hips. He leaned forward, pressed himself against Samuel, who was having that feeling again of dislocation, detachment, like at the bus stop this morning, as if he were seeing everything from a great distance. It looked absurd. It wasn't even him, he thought, down there, only an odd combination of parts that had never before been put together.
"Are you pretending?" Bishop said. "Is it working?"
Samuel didn't answer. He was far away. Bishop pressed harder against him, then released, then again, finding a slow rhythm. Samuel felt like a statue, incapable of doing anything but holding this pose.
"Pretend I'm her," Bishop said. "Make it happen, in your mind."
Bishop pressed into him, and Samuel felt that surge that happens so often in class, at his desk, that cascade of tension, that explosive, nervous, twitching warmth. Then looking down, seeing himself rising and swelling, knowing that he should not be rising and swelling, but doing it anyway, unstoppably, and how this seemed to clarify things, how it answered something important about him, about what had happened to him this day, and being absolutely convinced suddenly that everyone knew what he was doing right now. His mother and father, his teachers, Bethany, the police. Samuel was sure this was true, and it would remain with him for years, the event of his mother's departure locked in his mind with this moment in the woods, with Bishop, bonded in this way, pulsing against each other. Samuel not exactly liking it, but not hating it either, thinking the whole time that his mother knew exactly what he was doing, and she disapproved. It was, he decided, the reason she had gone. Part 3. Enemy, obstacle, puzzle, trap. Late summer 2011. 1. Samuel stood at the threshold of his mother's apartment, his hand on the slightly ajar front door, readying himself to open it but not yet feeling able to.
"Don't be scared," his mother had said.
It had been more than 20 years since she last uttered those words to him, and ever since that morning he'd felt haunted by her, always imagining that she was around, spying on him from a distance. He checked the windows at odd moments and scanned crowds for her face. He lived his life wondering what he looked like from the outside to his mother, who might be watching. But she never was watching, and it took a long time for Samuel to remove her from his thoughts. She had been a quiet, sleeping memory until this moment, and he tried to calm himself and center himself by repeating some of the advice he'd found last night as he scanned those websites. Start fresh. Don't insult each other. Maintain boundaries. Go slowly. Have a support network. And the number one thing, the big primary commandment, be prepared for your parent to be radically different from the person you remember. And it was true. She was different. Samuel walked into her apartment finally and found her sitting at a large wooden table near the kitchen, waiting for him like a receptionist. There were 3 glasses of water on the table and a briefcase. There were 3 chairs. She sat looking at him, not smiling, not having any reaction at all to his presence, just simply waiting, her hands in her lap. The long brown mane of her hair had been replaced by a short cut of military severity, turned to such a silver that it looked like a bathing cap. Her skin was wrinkled in that way common to people who have lost weight, under her arms, around her mouth, near her eyes. He was not expecting these wrinkles, and realized that in his imagination he had not been picturing his mother aging. He had to remind himself that she was by now 61 years old. She wore a simple black tank top that revealed the bony knobs of her shoulders and her thin upper arms. He worried suddenly that she hadn't been eating, then felt surprised to feel this way. Worried.
"Come in," she said.
There wasn't any other sound. His mother's apartment had a penetrating silence rarely found in the city. She stared at him. He stared back. He did not sit down. There was something unbearable about being too close to her right now. She opened her mouth as if to say something, but then did not say it. His mind emptied completely. A noise came from another room just then, a toilet flushing, a faucet turned on and off. Then the bathroom door opened, and out stepped a man in a white button-down shirt and a brown tie and brown slacks that were not exactly the same shades of brown. When he saw Samuel, he said, "Professor Anderson, sir," and offered a damp hand for shaking. "I'm Simon Rogers," the man said. "Of Rogers and Rogers, your mother's attorney, we spoke on the phone." Samuel looked at him for a moment, confused. The lawyer smiled pleasantly. He was a thin and short man with unusually broad shoulders. His brown hair was clipped close and arranged into the unartful and inevitable M-shape of early-onset male pattern baldness. Samuel said, "We need a lawyer for this?"
"I'm afraid that was my idea,"
he said. I insist on being present any time my client is being deposed as part of my service.
This isn't a deposition, Samuel said.
Not from your point of view, but of course you're not the one being deposed.
The lawyer clapped his hands together and moseyed to the table. He snapped open his briefcase and produced a small microphone, which he placed at the table's center. That his shirt fit his big shoulders but hung broadly on the rest of him made him look, Samuel realized, like a kid dressing in his dad's stuff.
My role here, the lawyer said, is to protect my client's interests, legal, fiduciary, emotional.
You're the one who asked me to come, Samuel said.
Indeed, sir. And the important thing to remember is that we're all on the same team. You agreed to write a letter to the judge explaining why your mother deserves lenience. My job is to help with said letter and make sure you are not here under, shall we say, false pretenses?
Unbelievable, Samuel said, but he wasn't sure what was more unbelievable, that the lawyer suspected Samuel of deceit or that the lawyer was right, because Samuel had no intention of writing any letter to a judge. He had come today to satisfy his contract with Periwinkle, to gather dirt on his mother so that he could eventually malign her publicly for money.
The purpose of today's inquiry, the lawyer said, is primarily to understand your mother's actions regarding her brave protest against the former governor of Wyoming, and secondarily to explicate why she's a great person. Everything else, sir, is outside our strict scope of interest. Would you like some water, juice?
Faye remained sitting and silent, not participating, but still taking up all the space in Samuel's mind. He felt wary of her like he'd feel wary of a buried landmine he knew the approximate but not exact location of.
Shall we sit?
The lawyer said. And together they joined Faye at the table, a rectangular table made of weathered wooden planks that probably had seen another life as a fence or barn. Three water glasses sat sweating onto cork coasters. The lawyer sat and adjusted his tie, which was mahogany-colored, as opposed to his more cocoa pants. He placed both his hands on his briefcase and smiled. Faye kept staring in her neutral, detached, indifferent way. She looked as austere and unfussy and bleak as the apartment itself, a single long space with a bank of windows facing north toward the tall buildings of downtown Chicago. The walls were white and bare. There was no television. There was no computer. The furniture was simple and restrained. Samuel noted the total lack of things that needed to be plugged in. It was as though she had ejected all unnecessary things from her life. Samuel sat across from her and nodded like he might nod to a stranger on the street, slight downward tilt of the chin.
Thank you for coming, she said.
Another nod.
How have you been?
She asked. He did not answer her immediately, but instead glared at her with an expression he hoped projected steely resolve and coldness.
Fine, he finally said.
Just fine.
Good, she said. And your father?
He's great.
Well, okay then, the lawyer said. Now that we've gotten that out of the way,
he laughed nervously,
why don't we go ahead and begin?
Small beads of sweat were now manifesting on his forehead. He picked involuntarily at his shirt, which was not exactly white, but that gray-white of something that's been washed many times, with definite yellow discoloring at the armpits.
Now, Professor Anderson, sir, this would be an ideal moment to ask your question regarding our primary interest today.
The lawyer reached across the table and pressed a button on the microphone that sat between Samuel and his mother. A small diode on the microphone glowed a placid blue.
And what question would that be? Samuel said. Regarding your mother's heroic protest against tyranny, sir.
Right. Samuel looked at her.
Up close like this, he found it difficult to reconcile this new person with the woman he used to know. She seemed to have lost all the softness of her former self, her long, soft hair and soft arms and soft skin. A new, harder body had replaced all that. Samuel could see the outline of her jaw muscles just below the skin, the ripple her collarbone made across her chest, the swell of her biceps. Her arms were like ropes that ships used to dock with.
Okay, fine, Samuel said. Why did you do it? Why did you throw rocks at Governor Packer?
His mother looked at the lawyer, who popped open his briefcase and fished out a single sheet of paper, dense with text on one side, which he handed to Faye and which she read verbatim. Regarding my actions toward Republican presidential candidate and former Wyoming Governor Sheldon Packer, hereinafter referred to simply as the governor, she said, and she cleared her throat, I do hereby attest, maintain, swear,
certify, and solemnly affirm that my throwing gravel in the direction of the governor should in no way be construed as an attempt to hurt, assault, injure, batter, maim, cripple, deform, mangle, or otherwise create a reasonable apprehension of an imminent, harmful, or offensive contact with the governor, nor anyone the gravel may have had inadvertent physical exposure with, nor was it my intention to inflict emotional distress, pain, suffering, misery, anguish, or trauma to anyone who witnessed or was otherwise affected by my purely political and symbolic actions. My actions were a necessary and essential and knee-jerk response to the governor's fascist politics and therefore, having no alternative with regards to the time, place, or manner of my response, not volitional, the governor's extreme right-wing, pro-gun, pro-war, pro-violence rhetoric, having put me under unusual and substantial duress to such a degree as to constitute a reasonable belief on my behalf of bodily harm to my person. I also believed that the governor's relentless and fetishistic law and order pro-violence stance implied consent to engage in violent roughhousing-type behavior in much the same way people who engage in sadomasochism for sexual gratification consent to being struck without criminal or civil liability. I chose gravel as the vehicle of my symbolic protest because my unathletic and crime-free background, in which I was never trained in a ball-throwing sport, meant that the danger posed by my casting tiny stones represented de minimis harm, and therefore the gravel was definitely not a dangerous, deadly, or aggravated weapon that I in no way used to purposely, knowingly, negligently, menacingly, recklessly, or with indifference to the value of human life, cause bodily injury. My purpose instead was solely, entirely, wholly, and altogether in every respect political, to communicate a political speech act that was neither inciting nor provocative, nor offensive nor presenting clear danger, a symbolic speech similar to protesters legally exercising their free speech rights by desecrating the flag or mutilating a draft card, etc. Faye laid the paper on the table, carefully and deliberately, like it was something fragile.
"Excellent," said the lawyer.
His face had grown red, a subtle but noticeable change from his previous pallor, which Samuel would describe as plastic baby creamy yellow. Blobs of sweat now clung to his forehead, like the way paint on exterior walls can bubble on a very hot day.
"Now that we're all clear on that front, let's take a little break."
The lawyer switched off the microphone.
"Excuse me,"
he said, and headed to the bathroom.
"He does that," Faye said, watching him go.
"He apparently needs to use the bathroom every 5 to 10 minutes. That's just his deal." "What the hell was that all about?" Samuel said.
"I'm guessing he goes to the bathroom to towel off the sweat. He's a very moist man. But he also does something in there involving quite a lot of toilet paper. I'm not sure what."
"Seriously," Samuel said, grabbing the paper and looking at it. "I have no idea what any of this means."
"He also has the tiniest feet, have you noticed?"
"Faye, listen," he said, and they both flinched at the use of her name. It was the first time he'd ever done that. "What is going on?"
"Okay, fine. Here's what I understand. My case is a seriously complicated one. Many charges of assault and several other charges of battery. Aggravated, first degree. I guess I scared a bunch of people in the park. Those are the assaults, but the rocks only struck a few of them. Those are the batteries. Plus also charges of, let's see." She ticked these off on her fingers one by one. "Disturbing the peace, public lewdness, disorderly conduct, resisting arrest. The prosecutor is being unusually aggressive, egged on by the judge, we believe."
"Judge Charles Brown."
"That's him.
The sentence for aggravated battery, by the way, is somewhere in between 300 hours of community service and 25 years in prison. That's a pretty wide range."
"The judge has a lot of discretion in sentencing, so you know that letter you're writing to him?"
"Yeah."
"It better be pretty damn good."
A whoosh of plumbing now, and the bathroom door opened and the lawyer returned, smiling, wiping his hands on his pants. Faye was right. He had the smallest feet Samuel had ever seen on an adult male.
"Fantastic," the lawyer said. "This is going really well."
How could he keep steady with those broad shoulders and those tiny feet? He was like a pyramid balancing upside down. The lawyer sat and drummed his fingers on his briefcase. "On to part two," he said. He turned on the microphone.
Our new subject, sir, is why your mother is an excellent human being with regards to why she shouldn't go to prison for upward of 20 years.
That's not really a possibility, right?
I believe not, sir, but I'd like to cover all my bases, obviously.
Now, would you like to hear about your mother's charitable giving?
I'm sort of more interested in what she's been up to these last couple decades.
The public schools, sir. She's doing some really excellent work in the public schools. Plus poetry. A real advocate for the arts, let me tell you.
This part is going to be tricky for me, Samuel said. This whole excellent human being part. No offense.
And why is that, sir?
Well, what am I going to tell the judge? That she's a great person? A wonderful mother? The lawyer smiled.
That's right. Exactly that.
I don't think that's something I could truthfully say.
And why not?
Samuel looked from the lawyer to his mother and back again.
Seriously?
The lawyer nodded, still smiling.
My mother abandoned me when I was 11.
Yes, sir, and as you can probably imagine, it's best that as little of that information about that part of her life reach the public as possible. She abandoned me without any warning.
Perhaps, sir, for our purposes, sir, you shouldn't think of it as your mother abandoned you. Instead, perhaps think of it as she gave you up for adoption slightly later than usual.
The lawyer opened his briefcase and produced a pamphlet.
Your mother actually did a lot more legwork than most birth mothers do, he said, in terms of looking into prospective adoptee families and ensuring her child landed in a positive environment and such. From a certain standpoint, I'd say her diligence in this matter could be considered above and beyond.
He handed Samuel the pamphlet. The cover was bright pink with pictures of smiling multicultural families and the words, "So you're adopted!" at the top in bubbly type.
I wasn't adopted, Samuel said.
Not literally, sir.
The lawyer was sweating again, a shiny film on his skin like what you might find on the ground on a dewy morning. A smear of liquid had now also appeared under his armpit and down his sleeve. It looked like his shirt was being swallowed slowly by a jellyfish.
Samuel looked at his mother, who gave him a sort of shrug like,
"What are you going to do?"
Behind her, out the bank of windows looking north, was the great gray face of the Sears Tower, hazy in the smoggy distance. It used to be the tallest building in the world, but it no longer was. It wasn't even in the top 5. Come to think of it, it wasn't even called the Sears Tower anymore.
"It's quiet in here," Samuel said. His mother frowned.
"What?"
"No traffic noise, no people noise.
It's very isolated."
"Oh, they were renovating the building when the housing market collapsed," she said. "They had only done a couple of units when they just left it, unfinished."
"So you're the only one in the building?"
"There's a married couple 2 floors up, bohemian artist types. We mostly ignore each other."
"Sounds lonely."
She studied his face for a moment.
"It suits me," she said.
"You know, I'd done a pretty good job forgetting about you," Samuel said. "Until these recent events."
"Is that so?"
"Yeah. I'd say you were pretty much forgotten until this week." She smiled and looked at the tabletop in front of her, a sort of inward smile that suggested some private thought now occurring to her. She swept the table with her palms, as if she were cleaning it.
"What we think of as forgetting really isn't," she said. "Not strictly speaking. We never actually forget things. We only lose the path back to them."
"What are you talking about?"
"I read this thing recently," she said. "There was this study about how memory works, this team of physiologists, molecular biologists, neurologists. They were trying to figure out where we keep our memories. I think it was in Nature, or Neuron, or JAMA."
"A little light reading?"
"I have many interests. Anyway, what they discovered is that our memories are tangible, physical things. Like, you can actually see the cell where each memory is stored. The way it works is, first you have a perfectly pristine, untouched cell. Then that cell is zapped and gets all deformed and mangled, and that mutilation is itself the memory. It never really goes away."
"Fascinating," Samuel said.
"I'm pretty sure it was in Nature, now that I think about it."
"You're serious?" Samuel said. "I'm burying my soul here, and you're talking about a study you read about?"
"I like the metaphor," Fay said. "And besides, you weren't bearing your soul, not even close, not yet."
The lawyer cleared his throat.
"Perhaps we should return to our topic," he said. "Professor Anderson, sir, if you'd like to begin your direct examination."
Samuel stood up. He paced one way, then another,
There was a single small bookcase along the wall, and this is where he went. He could feel his mother's eyes boring into his back as he inspected the shelves, mostly poetry, a large collection of Allen Ginsberg. Samuel realized that what he was really looking for was a copy of the famous magazine his story was published in. He realized this when he felt disappointed not to see it. He spun around. "Here's what I'd like to know." "Sir," the lawyer said, "you're out of microphone range?" "I'd like to know what you've been doing these 20 years, and where you went when you left us." "That, sir, is probably outside the scope of our inquiry." "And all this business about you in the 60s getting arrested, what they're saying about you on TV?" "You want to know if it's all true?" Faye said. "Yes." "Was I a radical? Was I in the protest movement?" "Yes." "Was I arrested for prostitution?" "Yes. There's about a month of 1968 unaccounted for. I had always thought you were in Iowa at home with Grandpa Frank waiting for Dad to come back from the army, but you weren't."
"No."
"You were in Chicago."
"For a very short time, yes. Then I left." "I want to know what happened."
"Ha ha," the lawyer said and did a little drum roll on his briefcase. "I think we've traveled slightly far afield, yes? Now perhaps we can get back to our subject."
"But you have other questions, right?" Faye said. "Even bigger questions?"
"We could get to those in time," Samuel said.
"Why wait? Let's get it all out in the open right now. Go on and ask me. There's only one real question."
"We could begin with the photograph, the photo taken of you at that protest in 1968.
"But that's not why you're here. Ask your real question, the thing you came here to find out."
"I came here to write a letter to the judge."
"You did not. Go ahead. Ask your question."
"It's not relevant."
"Just ask. Do it."
"It's not important. It's nothing." "I'd agree with that," the lawyer cut in. "Immaterial."
"Shut up, Simon," Faye said, then leveled her eyes at Samuel. "This question is everything. It's why you're here. Now why don't you stop lying and ask it?"
"Okay. Fine. I want to know. Why did you leave me?" And Samuel could feel the cry coming almost as soon as he said it. "Why did you leave me?" The question that had tormented his adolescence. He used to tell people she was dead. When they would ask about his mother, it was easier to say she'd died. Because when he told them the truth, they'd wonder why she left and where she'd gone, and he didn't know. Then they'd look at him funny, like it was his fault. Why did she leave him? It was the question that kept him awake night after night until he learned to swallow it and deny it. But asking the question now let it break back out. The shame and loneliness and self-pity washed over the question so that he was barely able to pronounce the last word before his throat tightened and he could feel himself on the verge of crying. They considered each other for a moment, Samuel and his mother, before the lawyer leaned across the table and whispered something into her ear. Then her defiance seemed to fizzle. She looked into her lap.
"Perhaps we should return to our topic,"
the lawyer said.
"I think I deserve some answers," Samuel said. "Perhaps we could get back to the subject of your letter, sir."
"I'm not expecting to be best friends," Samuel said. "But answering a few questions, is that too much to ask?" Faye crossed her arms and seemed to curl into herself. The lawyer stared at Samuel and waited. The sweat blobs on his forehead had grown thick and bulbous. At any moment they could rain down into his eyes.
"The thing about that article in Nature," Faye said, "the one about memory, what really struck me was how our memories are sewn into the meat of the brain. Everything we know about our past is literally etched into us."
"Okay," Samuel said. "What's your point?" She closed her eyes and rubbed her temples, a gesture of impatience and irritation that Samuel recognized from his childhood.
"Isn't it obvious?" she said. "Every memory is really a scar."
The lawyer slapped the top of his briefcase and said, "Okay, I think we're done here." "You haven't answered any of my questions," Samuel said. "Why did you leave me? What happened to you in Chicago? Why did you keep it secret? What have you been doing all these years?" And Faye looked at him then, and all the hardness in her body dissolved. She gave him that same look she'd given him the morning she disappeared, her face full of grief.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I can't."
"I need this," Samuel said. "You don't even understand how much. I need to know."
I've given you all I can. But you haven't told me anything. Please, why did you go?
I can't, she said. It's private.
Private? Seriously?
Faye nodded and looked at the tabletop.
It's private, she said again.
Samuel crossed his arms.
You goad me into asking this question and then you say it's private? Fuck you.
Then the lawyer was gathering his things, turning off the microphone, sweat dropping onto his shirt collar.
Thank you so much, Professor Anderson, for all your efforts, he said.
I didn't think you could get any lower, Faye, but congratulations, Samuel said, standing up.
Really, you're like a virtuoso, a maestro of being awful.
We'll be in touch, the lawyer said.
He ushered Samuel toward the front door, pushed him from behind with a warm, wet hand.
We will be in contact to touch base about how we can move forward.
He opened the door and walked Samuel through it. Liquid BBs hung onto the skin of his forehead. The area under his armpit was now a soggy mess, as if he'd spilled a movie theater-sized drink there.
We're very excited to read your letter to Judge Brown, he said, and good day.
He closed the door behind Samuel and locked it. All the way out of the building and for the whole long ride back through Chicago and into the suburbs, Samuel felt like he was going to crumble. He remembered the advice from those websites. Have a support network. He needed to talk to someone, but who? Not his father, clearly. Not anyone from work. The only people he regularly communicated with were his Elfscape friends, so once home he logged on. He was greeted by the usual barrage of, "Hey, Dodger, and good to see ya." He asked a question in guild chat. Any of you Chicago folks want to meet up tonight? I feel like going out. Which was met with an embarrassed silence. Samuel understood he'd crossed a boundary. He'd asked to meet in real life, a request usually made only by creeps and stalkers. He was about to apologize and tell them all to forget it when Ponage, their brilliant leader, the guild's Elfscape savant, finally, mercifully, wrote back.
Sure. I know a place.
2. Laura Potsdam sat in the frightening office of the university dean, explaining exactly what had transpired between herself and Samuel.
He told me I didn't have a learning disability, Laura said. He told me I just wasn't very smart.
Oh my goodness, the dean said, looking stricken. Her office shelves were filled mostly with books about the Black Death, her walls decorated with old-looking illustrations of people suffering from boils or lesions or being piled into wheelbarrows dead. Laura had not thought any wall art was more insufferable than her roommate's giant weight loss calendar, but the dean's apparent interest in the history of open sores proved her totally wrong.
Samuel really said out loud that you weren't smart?
It was a pretty big blow to my self-esteem.
Yes, I'd imagine. I'm an elite college student with a perfect GPA. He can't tell me I'm not smart.
I think you're very smart, Laura.
Thank you.
And you should know I take this very seriously.
I might also mention that Professor Anderson sometimes curses in class. It's really distracting and offensive.
Okay, here's what we can do, the dean said.
Why don't you rewrite your Hamlet paper for a new grade?
Meanwhile, I'll smooth things over with Professor Anderson. Does that sound like a plan?
Yes, that sounds like a great plan.
And if there's anything else I need to know, please call me directly.
Okay, Laura said.
And she walked out of the administration building feeling the bright, buoyant warmth that accompanies victory. It was a feeling that lasted only briefly, only until she cracked open her Shakespeare and sat on her dorm room floor looking forlornly at all those words, and realized she was right back where she started. Trying to complete yet another worthless assignment for yet another worthless class, Intro to Lit, one of 5 classes she was enrolled in this semester, all of which were, in her opinion, bullshit. Just totally stupid time sucks that had nothing to do with real life was what she thought about college classes so far, and by real life she meant the tasks she'd be asked to perform upon graduation with a bachelor's degree in business, tasks she couldn't even really guess at now since she hadn't taken any advanced communication and marketing classes and hadn't held an internship or real job
ever, unless you counted her high school gig working part-time at the concession stand at a second-run movie theater where she learned several important lessons about workplace etiquette from a 32-year-old assistant manager who liked staying after hours to smoke weed and play strip poker with the pretty teenage girls he always hired, which required of her a careful social negotiation to continue having access to the weed without doing anything so retrograde she couldn't show her face at work the next day. But even if this was the only quote-unquote work experience she'd ever had, she was still pretty sure her inevitably successful future career in marketing and communications would not require the stupid shit she was currently learning in college. Like Hamlet. She was trying to read Hamlet, trying to form a thought for an essay she had to rewrite about Hamlet. But the thing that was more interesting to her right now was a fistful of paperclips that she tossed lightly into the air and then watched as they bounced and scattered all over the linoleum of her dorm room floor. This was more fun than reading Hamlet, because even though every paperclip was shaped exactly like every other paperclip, they bounced in chaotic, random, unduplicatable ways. Why didn't they bounce exactly the same? Why didn't they all land in the same place? Plus, there was that delicious click, shh, sound when they all hit the floor and slid. She had lofted the paperclips into the air roughly 15 to 20 times in the last few minutes, a pretty transparent Hamlet-reading stalling maneuver, she had to admit, when her phone dinged. A new message. "Hey, hi," from Jason. She could tell by the several iterations of the letter E that he was feeling that very special, urgent way tonight. Boyfriends were so transparent sometimes. "Hey," smiley face. The reason college was so stupid was due to learning things she would never need in life, ever, like knowledge of Greek statuary, for example, such as she was memorizing for the intro to humanities class that was required of every student and that the university offered online. This was such a dumb waste of time because she was sure when she interviewed for her first real job, they would not show her flashcards of statues and ask, "What myth does this represent?" which was what she had to do in the timed 2-minute weekly quizzes the class required and that were such a total joke. Her phone chirped. It was an update on iFeel, the excellent new app that was the social media darling du jour among the college set. Laura's friends were all on it and used it obsessively, and would abandon it as soon as it was discovered by the late adopters, meaning old people. Laura looked at her phone. "I feel happy tonight," one of her friends had posted. It was Brittany, who had so far survived the several purges Laura had made to her alert list. The phone asked, "Do you want to ignore, respond, or auto-care?" Laura selected auto-care, placed the phone back on the floor, on the paperclips. What had she been thinking about? Right, the art quizzes, which were a total joke because all she had to do was scroll through the quiz-taking screen grabs along the way and then unplug her modem, which the test interpreted as a crash or network failure, i.e. not her fault, thus allowing her to take the quiz again. So she looked up all the answers and plugged in the modem and aced the quiz and didn't have to think about Greek statuary for another week. Then there was biology, which pretty much made Laura gag just thinking about it. Because she was pretty sure the first week of her powerful marketing and communications job that she would someday have would not require her to identify the chemical chain reaction that converted a photon of light to photosynthesize sugar, such as she was currently memorizing in her intro to biology class, that she was stupidly forced to take in order to satisfy a science requirement even though, hello, she wasn't going to be a scientist. Plus, the professor was so dry and boring and the lectures so unbearable. Her phone dinged again. A message from Brittany. "Thanks, girl," responding to whatever message I feel selected to auto-care with, obviously. And because Laura was in the middle of studying and trying really hard to read Hamlet, she decided not to engage and instead sent back the universal glyph signifying the end of a conversation. Smiley face. Anyway, the biology lectures were so unbearable she'd begun paying her roommate $20 a week to record herself reading aloud from the important parts of the textbook, so Laura could listen to the recording during the biweekly chapter tests when she sat inconspicuously next to the wall about halfway down in a 300-person lecture hall and slipped one small earbud into the wall side ear and leaned against the wall and listened to her roommate reading the chapter while scanning the test for key words, vaguely impressed by her own multitasking skills and her ability to pass the test without ever studying once.
You're not using this to cheat, are you? Her roommate asked a few weeks into the operation.
No, it's so I can study at the gym, Laura said.
Because cheating is wrong.
I know, and I've never seen you exercise.
I do exercise. I'm at the gym all the time and I've never seen you there.
Well, rat's eggs on you,
Laura said, which was something her mother always said instead of cursing. Something else her mother always said is don't let anyone ever bully you or make you feel bad about yourself. And at that moment, her roommate was making her feel very bad indeed, which was why instead of apologizing, Laura said, listen, Phoebe, if you haven't seen me at the gym, it's because some of us don't need to be there as long as you do. Because her roommate was, let's face it, objectively, morbidly, almost fascinatingly obese. She had legs like sacks of potatoes, for real. The word Phoebe was something she made up on the spot and felt pretty proud of, actually, how sometimes a nickname can capture a person's essence like that. Her phone dinged. What you doing tonight? Jason again, probing. He was never as obvious as when he wanted to sext. Homework. Sad face. The only class Laura was taking this semester that related in any way to her future was her one business class, macroeconomics, which was so abstractly mathematical and had basically nothing to do with the human element of business, which was really why she was going into this field at all, because she liked people and she was good with people, and she maintained a huge cavalry of online contacts who texted her and messaged her several times daily through the many social media sites she kept a presence on, which made her phone ding all day, repeatedly, the sound like a spoon lightly tapped against a crystal goblet, these pure high singing notes that made her feel bolts of Pavlovian happiness. And that was why she was a business major. But macroeconomics was so stupid and boring and unnecessary for her future career that she did not feel at all bad collaborating with a boy from her orientation group, a graphic design major and Photoshop artist who could, for example, scan the label of a Lipton green tea bottle, erase the ingredients list, a surprisingly long and sciencey thing for something that claimed to be tea, and replace the ingredients with an answer key to the test. All the formulas and concepts they were supposed to have memorized, matching exactly the original Lipton typeface and color so that there was no way